Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the first Sunday of Advent and the beginning of our adult education that will be focused on the season of Advent. We are very fortunate this morning to have with us Elizabeth Steele, who is a fourth-year student at Princeton Theological Seminary, earning her MDiv and MA in Christian Education and Formation. She has a BA in Art History from the University of Virginia, and she is currently exploring the capacity that art holds for theological reflection and formation, including an internship at the Princeton University Art Museum. She grew up in McLean, Virginia, and didn't know anybody could be anything other than Presbyterian until high school. We are very fortunate to have Elizabeth with us this morning. I think most of you are repeaters here in Adult Ed, but just a reminder that if Holly gets up in the middle to take a picture, it's not a paparazzi moment. It is for the purposes of contact tracing. So with that, we will turn things over to Elizabeth.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm very happy to be here with you this morning. You might have seen me around NASA. I usually teach the youngest members of our congregation, either in Worship Explorers or through some other things. But I think it's harder to talk to a four-year-old about God than it is with a group of adults. And so I'm very happy to be with you this morning. And so like Tae said, I'm a student at the seminary, and my background is in art history. And since I've been at the seminary, I've been able to put those two together and explore art theologically. And so I'm looking forward to doing that with you this morning. And the theme for this morning is finding joy in the art of Advent. And I know throughout Advent, you'll have different classes with different types of art, but this morning obviously is visual art. And so my hope today is that we'll be looking at several different works of art. And if you can't see, if I'm in the way, just let me know and I'll scoot out of the way. But we'll be looking at several different works of art in hopes of cultivating joy through them. And you don't have to like art to participate. Maybe you'll like art more after this. But we'll be looking at several different pieces. And I think this is appropriate for the beginning of Advent because it can be a very busy season. But I also think it's important, an important skill to find joy throughout the year. And my hope is that will become, our eyes will become more open by looking at these paintings, and we'll find joy not just in the 4 weeks before Christmas, but in every day. So before we dive into the art, I want to give us a working definition for what joy is. And this might seem simple, but joy is a little more nuanced than just a simple definition. And there's joy and happiness often get mixed and used interchangeably, but there's a difference between joy and happiness. And what we're looking for today is joy. And so happiness is external, whereas joy is internal. Happiness is an outer expression of an emotion, but joy is an inner feeling. A joy is communal, whereas happiness is more individual. Happiness is often tied to our control over situations or even over people, but joy affects others more easily and is passed on. So it's more communal than happiness. Third, joy transcends, whereas happiness just reacts. And happiness depends on what is happening around us, and it is affected by our external circumstances. Something, somebody makes me happy. But joy is a state that is independent of these circumstances, and sometimes joy is in spite of circumstances. So you can remember Paul in his letters expressing so much joy, even though he was in less than ideal situations. And then lastly, joy is a practice, whereas happiness is an emotion. Happiness comes and goes more easily, just like other emotions do, but joy is a practice and a behavior. Joy is deliberate and intentional. So this is the working definition that we're gonna use for joy today. It is eternal, internal, communal, joy transcends, and joy is a practice. So now we'll take a look at several pieces of art and see how we can cultivate joy through them and bring to mind scriptures from the Advent narrative. So we're going to encounter the pieces of art, and I have some questions. And this is a participatory class, and so if you have a response, just shout it out, you can raise your hand. There are no wrong answers when looking at art. And so I hope you feel comfortable doing that, but please feel free to answer as you see fit. Okay, so this is our first work. What is familiar to you here? The trees, and then hands. We have two fingers here, and then one hand over here. I'm sorry? In the back? What do you think? Mountains. Mm-hmm. We have some bricks, so like the corner of a building, maybe. What sort of mood does this evoke in you? What do the colors bring to mind? Fun. Mm-hmm. Certainly bright colors.
Difference.
Let's see, black trees, blue buildings. So there's a lot of contrast. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right here. Yeah. A book. Open book, maybe, that the hand is resting on.
Well, it looks like a landscape except the hands. So the hands are curious.
Mm. What makes you think it's a landscape?
Hmm.
Does anybody recognize this scene or what it could be? We have, let's see, so two hands, an open book. How about the artist? Any guesses about who the artist could be? There are some right answers in art, I suppose. This would be one of them. The Annunciation, it is. Mm-hmm. So this is the Annunciation. The full title of this is Leonardo da Vinci, The Annunciation, 323, and it's by Andy Warhol. And it is part of a series that Warhol, it was done in 1984, and it's part of a series called Details and Renaissance Paintings, and it is based on the original by Leonardo da Vinci. So, and this was done in around 1472 in the Renaissance. And so Warhol takes these classical paintings, this one, The Birth of Venus, St. George and the Dragon, and interprets them and interprets the scene that is familiar to us differently. And so this is what we're used to seeing with the Annunciation. So we have the angel Gabriel in his hand, somebody mentioned. He's holding a Madonna lily, and then, of course, Mary. And this is pretty trademark Leonardo. So in the back, somebody mentioned boats. Here, you can sort of see it's smoky. That's called sfumato, and Leonardo did that a lot. So that's one of his trademarks. Also, the wings of Gabriel look like bird wings. And Leonardo studied anatomy, and that often influenced the figures in his paintings. But this scene of the Annunciation is sort of imbued with Leonardo's contemporary cues. So like I mentioned, the Madonna lily, that represents Mary, but it also represents Florence. And this family that commissioned this painting was in Florence. This is, the table is a replica of a Medici tomb in Florence. So we have some mixing of the Bible story with contemporary cues about power and wealth and class. And it's interesting because, so I think somebody mentioned the hands. We have Gabriel's hands and then Mary's hands. And Warhol did a series of four of these paintings, his interpretations. So this is the one we're looking at up at the top. But he did three others in different colors. And so he zeroes in on the moment that Gabriel is communicating with Mary, that crucial moment where he's telling her what is about to happen. Warhol cuts away all of those contemporary cues and just zeroes in on the hands and what's being communicated. And so Gabriel's hand is in a posture of blessing or benediction, which is a common pose you might see in other renditions of angels, St. John the Baptist, even Christ. And then we see Mary's hand. We observe that it's on an open book, which is the Bible, of course. But the scripture doesn't tell us that she's reading the Bible. It doesn't tell us what she's doing, when Gabriel comes to her. And so many people infer that she was reading the Bible or in their interpretations. And so I wonder if in these interpretations they're pointing to a specific scripture that she might be reading. Would anybody have any guesses what she might be reading or what an artist would imply that she's reading when the angel comes to her?
Mm-hmm. Isaiah?
Maybe Isaiah. Mm-hmm. A prophet. The Magnificat. She could be, but that was my first thought too, always. But that is what's happening, you know? It's sort of the Magnificat is sort of unfolding in front of us, and also when she sees Elizabeth.
Genesis.
Could be Genesis, mm-hmm. They had the Hebrew scriptures and were steeped in that. Possibly Hannah's song before the birth of Samuel and her sort of longing for a child. Mm-hmm. This.
But it also to me it looks like a beer. So that's B-I-E-R.
Let's go back and see the original.
So
here.
It's not necessarily related to a chair.
No, I'm sorry, this was down here, the table.
That's the table. Okay.
Yeah, so about here, he zeroes in on.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So this, I think it would be like the opening or the wall of a garden into the back. Mm-hmm.
Warhol sure makes a big deal out of the mountain. Like the comparison to Da Vinci, right, where you have to kind of look close to see the mountain.
Mm.
And all of his is like kind of really centered.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The hands are, you don't see them quite at first, even though they're sort of tucked in the corners, but whereas the Leonardo had the fog, the smoke, the sfumato, the mountains are front and center. And by changing the colors, of course, it draws our eyes to that. So it's an interesting choice that he makes. So I think here we can remember our first characteristic of joy, which is that joy is internal, whereas happiness is external. And so when Mary's circumstance changes, her joy remains. And you'll also remember a few verses after Gabriel comes to Mary. Mary visits her cousin Elizabeth, and they have an exchange, and Elizabeth says that the baby in her womb leapt with joy upon seeing Mary and the baby that Mary has. So her circumstances aren't exactly as blessed as we would see them now. But in that day, an unwed virgin that was just given some very life-altering news, her reaction could be one of many things, but it is joy. And the Magnificat, as mentioned earlier, is her response. And she says, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God, my Savior." And so, we have to remember we're looking back at this so many years later, and we've got the whole story, and she has just the snippet of a story and doesn't know how it's going to end. But still, despite her circumstances, her response is joy. So this reminds us that joy is internal. Okay, so let's look at another interpretation of the same scene. How is this different than the Annunciation that we saw with Warhol or even with Leonardo?
Crowded.
It's crowded. Yeah. They are very distant. And in Renaissance and sort of classical paintings of Gabriel and Mary, there's always a distance between them. But here, Gabriel is very close to Mary.
Mary's black.
It's hard to tell. So yeah, so they're very close. Gabriel's in Mary's face, and it's hard to tell our reactions, if there are even any implied or emotions. But the face of Mary is pretty flat and doesn't give a lot away.
You know, and the direct gaze.
We don't have any clues necessarily that this is Mary, except that she has a blue headdress. She's not wearing, she doesn't have hair. And he's done other versions of this where she has a more pronounced stomach, but she's sort of holding her hand maybe in front of it. It's hard to tell what is clothes and what is shapes here. So there's a bit of interpretation work that we have to do. Does this remind you of anything else?
Mondrian,
yeah. Why is that? You know, I didn't even notice that before, but right here?
Yeah.
Could be. The paintings that she's speaking of are squares, lines, bright colors, primary colors, big canvases, very geometric lines, squares, rectangles.
Mary's face reminds me of Jacob
Lawrence. Mary's face reminds Carol of Jacob Lawrence.
I don't understand the blue face.
Gabriel's face? Here? I think we can assume that this is Gabriel's face because he's got the halo around him. No, I don't think that matters. If we're going to start picking at that thread, then don't go to the MoMA. It's not okay. What title would you give this painting?
Someone's beckoning Mary.
That's right. In the Warhol and the Leonardo, Gabriel's hands were in a benediction or a blessing. But here they're turned almost like this, like come closer. And you're gonna, here's the news, you're gonna listen. Yeah, in your face. It is much, much more intimate than the last one we saw. We see all of Gabriel and his wings, and he's curved. And then Mary is, she might be sitting, but her back is definitely against something, and there's nowhere to go. So the title of this one is called Tidings, and it's by Romare Bearden in 1970. And Romare Bearden was an African-American artist who's well known for depicting the African-American experience in abstract collages. So it is abstract. Everything doesn't quite fit together, but not so much that we can't tell what scene this is or what is going on. And this painting focuses on the notion that Gabriel's news to Mary was joyful. Because tidings, the word tidings dates back to a 13th century Norse word that also means news, and it was incorporated into Old English with the word tiden, which means to happen. So it is like news of what has happened or what is happening. And it's a word, tidings, that we hear often in the holiday season. And carols like, "We wish you a Merry Christmas," "God rest ye merry gentlemen." And tidings appears in the King James Version of Luke 2:10 when the angel comes to the shepherds to announce the news of Jesus' birth. And he says, "Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people." And so this reminds us of the second characteristic of joy. Happiness is individual, but joy is communal. Tidings are not individual or hoarded. You don't keep them to yourself. You don't usually keep good news to yourself. But you share it and you exchange it, and good news is spread. And it's spread to all of the people, which the Advent story tells us. And it's important to note also who it was spread to first, to the shepherds, to the most lowly, to the most unexpected first recipients. And so I think this maybe should also make us think about and question who we're sharing the good news with and our joy with, our tidings with, and how we do that, and how often we do that, and with whom. So this is tidings. Okay, this is our next picture, and it is a little bit different than what we've been looking at. What is your first reaction to this work? More restful because of the color.
There's no people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a picture book. Which one, the large one or the small one? The large one.
What is written on the yellow book?
That is Joie de Vivre by Emile Zola. So it is very simple. Let's name what we see. Some of the yellow book. There's the large book somebody said. Candles.
Here it looks like the candles aren't lit. Mm-mm.
So no.
Burned down, so the work is, it looks like a scholar has left his, or probably his, work, and so he's finished for the night.
Mm.
The candles burned down.
Mm-hmm. Right, where do you think, would they be sitting, standing in front of it?
Yeah, right, lying in front of that table with kitty corner, you're not looking at it straight on, you're coming at it kind of sideways. And it's just a little bit of a
mm-hmm.
A child's view of a table.
Mm-hmm. It would be sort of at their eyesight. Mm-hmm. Both books look well used. Mm-hmm. Why do you think? Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Whatever it's sitting on.
There's a contrast in size between the two books. But both of them look well used.
Mm-hmm. So the artist is making some interesting choices. Perspective, it's a little unsettling. It's not quite right. We're not quite sure where we're standing or how we're viewing it. It's a still life. There are no people. There's not a lot of action. But he's also telling us something about the objects that are in the painting, that they're well used, that they're familiar. Somebody mentioned the candles, that they look well-worn, but not lit. Any guesses to the artist? You will recognize the name. I promise, for the most part. It is. Yes, that's because it is one. This is Still Life with Bible by Van Gogh in 1885. So this is his father's Bible. And Van Gogh's father was a Protestant minister. And for a time, and he painted this a few months after his father passed away. And for a time before he became a painter, Van Gogh wanted to be a pastor. And he went into ministry ministry to minors, and went through school but failed his theological exams. And the committee that was sponsoring him decided that he was unfit to be a pastor. And so they ended his bid for that, and he sort of gave up that effort around 1877. So that was about 10 years before he painted this. But for a long time, he thought he would go into the ministry. And then, as somebody else noted, the small yellow book, that book is Joy de Vivre by Emile Zola. And Van Gogh wanted to contrast the worldview of his father with the Bible. And then with Joy de Vivre, he saw as a Bible for modern day life. And so he's putting these together in tension. And I tried very hard to see which book the Bible is open to. And I think it's Isaiah in French. Does anybody know the Monet painting Impression Sunrise? It sort of was the first Impressionist painting. And it's got oranges and grays and blues. And when Monet put it in the exhibit, everybody was offended. And that's how Impressionism sort of took flight. This, the inside of the Bible, especially right here, is very reminiscent of that painting. And when Van Gogh painted this, he was in a debate with his brother Theo and about the use of color. And his brother Theo wanted him to use more bright colors like the Impressionists were doing, but Van Gogh wanted to prove to his brother that black could be just an effective of a color. And so it's not as bright as some of the other Van Goghs that we might be familiar with, but he puts this pop of sort of lemon yellow in as a nod to his brother and to draw our attention to that book. There's this juxtaposition between, like I said, his father's worldview and then the worldview that the smaller book represents. So I kind of see this as the peace of God with the Bible versus the pressures of the world with the Zoila book. And it kind of brings to mind the question, where do you find yourself in the tension between these two? Brené Brown is a professor and a sociologist, and she says a lot of things. She's very well known, but she researches, and so she backs up what she says. And she researched joy for over 12 years, and she found that joy is the most difficult and terrifying emotion that we experience as humans. And she says this because she found that with joy, there's always a fear of loss. So there's always this shadow side, not always, but mostly waiting for the other shoe to drop, scared that all of our joy will be taken away. And she calls this foreboding joy. And what we usually do then is try to get ahead of that joy, ahead of the disappointment, and ahead of the vulnerability to protect ourselves for when we think it's going to go away. And so we try to temper joy and get ahead of it. We dress rehearse tragedy and disappointment so we can beat it to the punch. And so this painting sort of reminds me of that shadow side of joy, that we have pressures of the world that are pulling us from the peace of God where we know we will find joy, but we are trying to get ahead of it just in case. And so this foreboding joy, as she calls it, and this painting reminds me of this verse that we find in the beginning of John. And now, of course, in John, there's not a birth narrative. We get a much more cosmic view of Christ and how he came into being and how all things came into being through Christ. But John tells us that the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. And this reminds us of the third characteristic of joy, that joy transcends. Happiness is a reaction, but joy transcends. So no matter the circumstances, joy will transcend them. And we may try to get ahead of the sting or the disappointment, the darkness, or the death, But as John reminds us, the darkness will not overcome it. The light, the joy of God, will always transcend. Okay.
Matisse.
Correct. So this is a Matisse. Very different than the last painting that we saw. Do you think that this is a narrative or abstract? And why? Why do you say both? Down here.
I saw the hand as the angel's wings, and so I immediately jumped to the story of the angels coming to the shepherds.
This also is angel wings down here.
I see the creation story.
How so? That's interesting. The shapes are very organic, so it sort of lends to that notion of creation.
Perhaps it's abstract because we are all seeing so many different things.
Well, that's the thing with art. There's many different ways to see it. Oh, and rivers down here, maybe? What setting could this be in, or where would you put something like this? It's pretty large. The church window? Because of the breaks in it? What sort of mood does this one evoke in you? Celebratory. Lightness. It is a stained glass window, but it is not in a church. I'll tell you where it was in a minute. Yeah. What title would you give this one? Seems like we could have a lot of different options depending on what you see. Blast. Right, it could be a different creation story that way, yeah. Keep looking up. The light of the world. So the title of this one is Nuit de Noël, which is Christmas Eve in French. And it was by Matisse, as somebody said earlier. And it was he did it in 1952. And it was commissioned as a stained glass window by the Time Life Company to hang in Rockefeller Center during the holiday season. And so it's a little bit of a mix of the secular and religious. So it is a stained glass window, but it never saw its way into a church, nor I don't know that it was meant to. it's owned by the MoMA now, and it's not on show, but they show it occasionally in shows. And towards the end of his career, Matisse was diagnosed with cancer, and he couldn't hold his paintbrushes and paint like he used to, and so he started to cut with scissors, and he called it painting with scissors. And he painted large sheets of paper and then cut them out or had his assistants cut them out, big, big shapes. And maybe some of you have seen these installations. There's one at the Barnes, several in Washington, D.C. So he would cut very large shapes and then hang them even around the entire room and paint that way and put these pieces together. There's a chapel in France, actually, where he that he designed based on this method of painting. And he sort of saw this as a second life after his cancer diagnosis and a different way to create art. And the thing that is interesting about this, one of the interesting things, is that somebody noticed the stars and the different points. And instead of painting a large yellow sheet of paper and then cutting the shape out, he would cut triangles and build these shapes together. And so pictures of him in the studio at this time, his studio, there are just hundreds of pieces of paper scattered along the floor. And he would just pick up pieces and put them together and pin them to the wall and make these creations. Here is a picture of the stained glass window. So the painting that we saw was a model for this window. And then this is the actual window. So it's large, but it's not, it would look fairly small in a church, probably. But this is the original window and how it was meant to be seen. And so you can see, especially in the stained glass medium, the sections and the shapes, how they were put together more piece by piece instead of whole. Mm-hmm. This is an installation, and these people are looking at it. So just to give you an idea of the size. Mm-hmm. So you would be looking up at this. This is probably closer than you would have seen in Rockefeller Center when it was installed.
Mm-hmm. And in the pink prototype version, it looks very springy. What Roz was saying, you know, kind of a creation narrative, that resonated with me. But when I see the actual installation, it does look like a traditional Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Right, these colors in the model are more springy, tropical, not what we associate normally with Christmas or holiday. I wonder, I don't know, I wonder what the reaction was when this was put up in 1952. It's very different than what people would know Matisse for with his still lives and something that's more figurative. So today it seems fairly harmless, but in 1952, abstract was still new, was still something that they were that people were learning about and seeing for the first time. So I do wonder what the reaction would have been like. Now, I will tell you that this is my favorite painting. And I don't know the first time I saw it, maybe in high school or before then. There are some cutouts in Washington, D.C., near where I'm from. And I don't know what has always drawn me to this painting, but I always feel sort of pulled toward it. And before I came to seminary, I owned a business, a store in Charlottesville. And in the back, I had a little room where I did all the accounting and the taxes and the payroll and all of the stuff that is not fun that you have to do with the business, but you don't think about when you open the business. And so I have a rather large copy of this painting, and I put it in the back of my store so that when I sat down to do the taxes and the accounting and the payroll, this would be next to me. And it always brought me a sense of peace and joy, just sort of looking at it and letting the colors come out. It's not very narrative, and it's interesting to hear your thoughts because I've never thought of you know, these as rivers or a hand or the angel. I just always associated the star with Christmas Eve, and that was good enough for me. But I am glad that you shared some of the different interpretations. And these shapes that he does are pretty common within the cutouts. Like I said, very organic. Some of them are figurative. Some of them are less so. And this one has always kind of been in the middle for me. There was a show at the MoMA about 7 or 8 years ago of the cutouts. And I think that was the last major time that they were shown, and the window was shown. And it was in December, so it was right before the holidays. And so this painting reminds me of the final characteristic of joy that I mentioned earlier, and that is that joy is a practice. Happiness is an emotion, but joy is a practice. And I think somebody mentioned the star and the wise men or the magi. And Matthew tells us when they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. And this brings me back to Brené Brown with her notion of foreboding joy. What she also found in her research is that what the difference between joyful people and people who are not is what they do next in that moment. They feel the foreboding joy and that shudder and that kind of scarcity that it'll be taken away. But the difference is that the next thing that they do is practice gratitude. And so instead of going down that path and following the foreboding feeling, they stop and practice gratitude for the joy that they're feeling. And I think that the Magi show us what this is. So they are overwhelmed with joy, something that they don't know much about, that they've been following, that they might be scared with. They're overwhelmed with joy. And the next thing that they do, Matthew tells us, that they knelt down and paid homage to Jesus. So they praised God, they felt the joy, and then they praised God. So to experience joy, we also have to practice gratitude, and the two go hand in hand. So I wonder what your practices of joy might look like and feel like, and then what practices of gratitude follow that. We've just come out of Thanksgiving, and it's easy to talk about gratitude when everybody else is, when it's the theme of the week or the season. But I hope you remember that with joy also comes gratitude, and in that gratitude, you're able to more fully feel the joy of God. So as a reminder, joy is eternal. Happiness is external, based on circumstances, but joy is an internal state. Joy is communal. Happiness is more individual, something we feel ourselves, but joy is shared. Remember tidings and that they are to be passed along. Joy transcends. It transcends our circumstances, transcends the pressures of the world. And lastly, joy is a practice. Whereas happiness is an emotion, joy is a practice that comes hand in hand with gratitude. So I wonder, and maybe we have a few minutes, if there's a painting in particular that either you connected with or that sparked this notion of joy within you, or that is thinking or making you think of how you practice joy differently now, or how you could going forward.
Mm-hmm. There's something about the close-up in the second painting in particular, as you have it here, that really helps me to focus on come.
Mm-hmm. There is a lot going on in that painting. And right, to focus on just the exchange between the angel and Mary. And in scripture, we're not told what Mary's doing. We're not told how close they are. I mean, it's an angel. And then some different interpretations, especially more modern ones, he's in her bedroom or somewhere a little bit closer. But this is very close and intimate.
Into the gospel tradition, which also brings people, you know, his interpretation of Annunciation versus Leonardo.
Mm-hmm.
Where Mary and Gabriel have separation.
Mm-hmm. And they don't look very happy to be sharing or receiving this news. Yeah.
Yeah. So the sense of community is very different. I prefer Bearden's interpretation as well.
Mm-hmm.
I associate Dora with dancing, and the Lord of the Dance is a hymn that expresses that. And if someone starts dancing, other people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And contagious. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think it's fairly easy to find joy in Advent. And I was telling Corey, there's always an energy about Advent and things going on and pageants and crafts and things like that, but I hope that by looking at these pieces of art and maybe an art that you see out in the world or that you encounter from here on out, that you find the joy of God in the days after Advent, in the days before, and in every day that we have. And thank you for letting me walk through this with you. It's always, always interesting to see. I have seen this painting, the Matisse painting, hundreds of times, and not notice some of the things that came out for you. So thank you for being willing to share and to look through these.
Elizabeth, thank you so much. And thank you all. And I'm sure we've got a little bit of time if there are any other questions or things that you would want to kind of get at Elizabeth's brain, and clearly she is like a fountain of information. So we do have a little bit of time for that if there are questions that we didn't get to during the presentation. Oh, well. Then, never mind, friends. Then let me tell you, next week we are going to have Paul Roram talking about the hymns of Advent. So I just want to thank Elizabeth again and invite all of you to join us for next week and Dr. Roram. Thanks so much. Yay.